Every Woman is a feminist show about women and girls making a difference and the men who support us. As 50% of humanity and 53% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in the social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The views and opinions expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, KKFI, staff, volunteers, board, or management.
And you're here with us this week on Every Woman. With me in the studio today is Una Nowling, my wonderful wife, and the equally wonderful Ember Urbach, and I'm your other host, Fiona Nowling.
Ember is not your wife, though. Not yet.
No. But just as wonderful, so.
I did say equally wonderful.
I feel like I'm doing pretty good if I can get that.
So. At least at hosting shows.
Right.
I don't know if you can cook as well as she can.
Challenge accepted.
Or fence as well.
Are you trying to get like another sister wife or something? Because I said I'm not open to too many others.
Not too many, though.
How many are you open to? Or should we negotiate this off air?
Yeah, this isn't about me.
it's about me.
It's always about you. So today, we're going to talk about feminist issues and issues that matter to our listeners. We've got a lot of topics to discuss. We're going to have a bit of a round table, and we will also throw the phone lines open to anyone who wants to call in and either share their opinion on something we're discussing at the time or has a burning issue they want to bring to people's attention. And the number for that is 816-931-5534. So, first topic, Ember.
Yeah, so this actually happened on October 19th, so we're a little late talking about this, but last week we had a full schedule, and it kind of falls in line with some of the stuff that we've been talking about. There was a 22-year-old woman walking down 75th Street in Waldo on the way to church on a Thursday, at 4:30 in the afternoon, and some men drove by in a vehicle and shouted something at her. She didn't really hear it. Decided to call her mother on the phone because she was feeling unsafe and wanted to have someone to talk to. And then the man pulled up again closer to her, asked for her phone number. She declined, and he pulled a handgun out and shot near her feet and drove off because she would not give a stranger in a car her phone number.
Yeah, and he yelled something at her about you should be careful how you talk to people in future or something. Because obviously giving a completely strange man your phone number is considered careful.
Right.
Ironically, I would imagine if his girlfriend had been approached by a strange man on the street, he would have backed her up completely if she had said, well, no way did I want to talk to that person or whatever. But it's part of the extension of men claiming women as property, even if they don't actually have a relationship with them. He already had in his mind that this woman on the street was inferior to him, that she was ripe for the picking. She was property. He was man.
Yes.
And this idea that saying no is some like rude, horrible act. And this is something that is kind of ingrained in women and girls as we grow up, is that you have to be polite to everyone. You have to smile. You know, you need to be polite and have a good demeanor. And even if you're just saying no to giving someone your phone number, all of a sudden you are a horribly rude person, let alone if she had, you know, said something that we can't say on the radio to him.
Yes.
Or stuck up a particular finger. I mean, like, all she said was no. And not that any of that would have made it okay.
And I think the comment that Una made about he may have a girlfriend, it's entirely possible, given his attitude, that he may actually be one of the people that you see referred to online by themselves as incel, involuntary celibate, because they're such a disgusting example of a human being that no woman in their right mind will have anything to do with them, and so they hate all women and take it out on any women that they meet.
I wonder, you know, there is a lot of theory goes into the fact that aggressiveness and violence against women who reject even casual advances, even light banter, plays in directly to a threat to masculinity. If the man is speaking to you and you do not respond with a smile, you do not respond with a pleasantry, you do not give some indication of interest, then what you've actually done is you have emasculated him in front of the entire world. And even if nobody is actually witnessing it, I guess you've emasculated him in front of himself. And so that really, that theory really plays into why there would be such a violent reaction.
And thinking about, you know, these groups of men who call themselves incels, which is involuntarily celibate, kind of view sex from women as an entitlement. And that if they are not getting it from women, it's not that they have a problem or they have barriers or they have, you know, some sort of social emotional deficit or something like that. Not that there's anything wrong with not having sex, but that it's on the woman to provide that, to like seek out men to pass on this entitlement of sex to.
Yes.
And it's really heterocentric and really gross.
And so many of the school shoot-ups have been young white males who have, some of them have gone on the rampage because a girl turned them down for the prom. And they've been brought up because they're the all-American male and everything should be given to them on a platter, and they have all this privilege of being white and male. And no one ever taught them that just because you're white and male doesn't mean you're guaranteed anything, except anything that's guaranteed under the Constitution. The pursuit of happiness, it doesn't actually mean you'll be happy.
Another related phenomenon is one that gets a lot of ground in some social media circles. It's the nice guy syndrome. The people claiming that they are nice guys, they deserve to have women. And thus, the fact that women are rejecting them is because of the actions of, you know, hairy-legged lesbian bookstore, you know, employees or whatever.
Yes. A la Portlandia. And it's, you know, I've seen this comic that it always reminds me of when I see these quote-unquote nice guys, is that women are not vending machines that you put niceness coins in and then they pop out sex for you, you know.
And the calling themselves nice guys is kind of like a self-assessment, you know. It's like, well, sure, yeah, I may be cruel to animals every now and then, and I may, you know, wash myself with a rag on a stick, but I'm a nice guy.
Or it's the, well, I just stared at your boobs for the last half hour and didn't ever look you up in the face, but you still owe me sex because I'm a nice guy, because I didn't actually grab your boobs and squeeze them. That's the definition of being not a nice guy. I didn't assault you.
And this is not to make an excuse for men who behave that way, but I think that in our society, men who do not abuse, men who do not push boundaries, men who do not take advantage of women are seen as exceptional in some circles. We know statistically that's not true, but it becomes seen as something that's exceptional. And so men who are not committing crimes and violating people, some of them seem to think that they're very special. Very special.
Yes. Plus there's the guys that say, when they ask you out and you say, no, I'm not going to go in your car with you, I'm not going to go back to your place with you because anything could happen. And they say, I'm not like that, I'm a nice guy. And it's like, that's just what a rapist would say. He's hardly likely to come up to you and say, hi, I'm a rapist, would you like to go back to my place?
Right. I met my husband online, and this was back in, you know, this is in 2010, so online dating was kind of a thing, and it wasn't super foreign at the time, but I was like, we're driving separately, we're meeting in a public place, and we're leaving separately on our first date, and we'll see where we go from there. And he was like, all right, I get it. And had he been like, oh, come on, like, everything's going to be fine, I would have been like, everything's probably not going to be fine if you're so worried about me driving my own car, like, if that's so threatening. And so, moral of the story, let her drive her own car and everything will be fine. Probably.
It's sort of typified by our president, who is on camera openly joking that he can get women to do whatever he wants because he has money. And if they won't do what he says or they won't respond naturally to his quote-unquote charm, that he would grab them by their private parts and he could get away with it. And I have to wonder, what does a Republican or conservative parent, how do they explain to their young children that this is the person they voted for, that I want you to treat women with respect, but all the same, I voted for the least respectful person that could possibly have been on the ballot?
And at the time of the election, there was still an outstanding case against him for not just rape, but being a pedophile. Because in the state of New York, there was a case being heard to see whether the statute of limitations applied or not to this case, because she was a child at the time. She's now legally an adult. And he had, according to this person, he had threatened to kill her if she ever told anyone about it. And that was why they were seeing whether the statute of limitations applied to it, because it was an ongoing fear situation. And so the crime had effectively never ended.
Right.
Wait a minute. Wait. How does something like pedophilia actually fall under a statute of limitations? I mean, the statute of limitations is supposed to set a sunset for prosecuting like jaywalkers or barking dog complaints, not pedophiles.
Well, apparently women and children aren't actually that important because they don't earn enough to be able to buy people in Washington to stand up for them. And so that's why the statute of limitations applies to some of these acts. I believe that the New York Senate and House have been looking at altering whether or not statute of limitations should apply to rape and pedophilia, because there is often an ongoing threat.
Gosh, you think?
And we've also seen, you know, especially as forensic science has gone from more of just theoretical to an actual science, and DNA evidence has gotten more robust, that the state of Kansas actually did alter or remove, I can't recall which, the statute of limitations for sexual assault if DNA evidence is recovered. So if a forensic kit was done at the hospital but that person chose not to press charges at the time, maybe because they were worried about death threats or something like that, they would be able to do that down the road, or if evidence was recovered down the road. And so I think people are taking steps in the right direction, but there's definitely been an effort to silence victims of sex crimes through these statutes of limitations, I think.
Plus the whole thing of not actually bothering to process the sex kits.
Absolutely.
There are thousands and thousands of them, and the backlog and the money to pay for getting them done would be in the millions. But Johnson County last year had a initiative on the ballot to add an extra quarter of a cent or something onto sales tax, not to do things like treat the backlog of untested sex kits, or perhaps to train the police to not commit crimes of racism or sexism, but instead to build a new courthouse and place for the judges and police to hang out in comfort around cases, and to refurbish their attorney general's office.
Yeah, I think it really speaks to what the priorities are in our criminal justice system. And And who knows, you know, a lot of times with these ballots, we don't know the whole story that's going on behind them, but there's definitely a national problem with this backlog. And it's already such a difficult thing for someone to do. I've sat with people before and after and during. They've had forensic kits done, and it's a very long, hard process. And to know that there are kits just sitting in warehouses untested is really horrific. And a lot of these sexual abusers are serial abusers, and there likely are other victims who, you know, could have otherwise been spared had these kits been tested and prosecuted.
They have actually had cases where that's been actually the truth that happened. When the person's picture was up on the TV, someone said, "That's who raped me," and they had an untested rape kit, mm-hmm. and they could have caught him earlier and saved two or three other victims. And that's just the ones that we know about.
Right, absolutely. It's pretty horrific.
So it's entertaining in the... I read an article about the Me Too, and that white males in positions of power no longer just have to worry about lawsuits from people and being able to pay hush money to get these sex crimes to go away. It said, in the current era, it's much more dangerous and much harder to be a sexually abusive male in a position of power, because you might actually get fired for it. And I was like, how is it a much harder environment when people knowingly voted to put an accused rapist and admitted sexual offender and groper into the White House? And then in addition to that, because of the fun that people have been having by actually getting to tell the stories of how they've been abused so often by people, state houses have been coming out, and women that have been lobbyists or women that have been candidates have been coming out and telling their stories, and they're actually having investigations in several states into sexual harassment and the culture in their chambers. But former President George H.W. Bush has been accused by two women actresses of groping their bottoms. And not just groping their bottoms, he also actually joked about it. He had a joke which was, it's hard to actually tell it, but he made the insult of groping their bums worse by telling a joke about groping people's bottoms at the same time, because he asked them who their who his favorite magician was, and he said it was David Copperfield.
That's gross.
Yeah. So they have this week put out a statement saying he never intended any offence by groping people's bottoms, and he was just meant to be done in a friendly fashion.
I think that, you know, this glossing over it and kind of minimizing these incidents is a big part of the culture right now. You know, that, oh, well, you know, what he said to you isn't as bad as what I've heard other men yell to other men. I've heard this week, you know, men threaten to kill men all the time in bar fights and stuff like that. And it's like, okay, that's bad too.
Yes.
Like, we can approach violence from multiple angles. And when we're talking about violence against women, that's its own thing. And violence between and among men is another important thing we need to tackle, but not at the expense of derailing conversations about violence against women, violence against LGBT individuals, violence against people of color. You know, we don't need to be derailing these conversations. If that's important to you, then start that conversation in addition, not at the expense of these main conversations we're having.
Yes. I mean, his handlers or associates
I think at this point it's probably handlers.
Yes. They tried in several different ways to downplay it. They said that the woman in question shouldn't have stood next to him for the photo opportunity. It's like, it's a photo opportunity for your career, and it's going to look awkward and weird if you don't stand next to the president and you're not expecting him to grab your bum. And then in a separate statement about it, they said that he's been in a wheelchair for the past 5 years, so his arms are naturally going to be lower. It's automatically at bum level. But it's not an accidental thing if you are telling a sleazy joke at the same time as doing it. It's not other people are in wheelchairs and disabled and don't go around grabbing everyone's bum all the time.
And they used a wheelchair.
That's not one of the words.
Plenty of people's arms are at chest level, and they don't accidentally grab on to things at that level.
Sometimes they do. I'll just walk towards you going like this with
right.
my hands. Sorry, I'm making gestures of clenching and releasing my hands
right.
multiple times.
And I've admit, I have been bumped accidentally, but you can tell when it's an accident, and you can tell when it's intentional.
Yes.
And I think using the wheelchair as an excuse is just so disgusting, and I think it's also could be insulting to other wheelchair users.
Yes,
that they just don't know how to control their arms and gravitate towards booties.
People's bottoms.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it was interesting that when the first account came out, people were like, oh no, she's hopping on this bandwagon, I'm sure nothing happened. And then he like straight up admitted it and was like, sorry, I meant this molestation to be a joke.
Yeah, at least he didn't make them look out to be frauds and fakes and deny it. And so he did the minimum possible to be on the road to rehabilitation and being vaguely a decent human being in actually admitting he did it.
Yeah.
But so many other people don't admit they do it, such as the accusations against O'Reilly recently.
Oh, goodness.
And that's a case where we're actually having to call out Megyn Kelly as a voice for women's rights, because he was accused of fostering an unhealthy work atmosphere for women and of possibly harassing and possibly molesting women that were under his power because of his position. And she stood up and said, yes, this happens. And he, in addition, doubled down and said, and I've never been accused of anything like this before. And so she said, yes, you've been accused of it. I have commented on your dismissal of sexual assault stories as fostering a bad environment for women and anyone who's been a sexual assault survivor. And she had even sent an email, which she was able to present, to Fox, saying, I sent this email about this topic. And so many people that wouldn't listen to people that were, say, in the academic environment that study sexual assault and sexual abuse and power abuse in the workplace and in the media would not listen to people like that because they would say, oh, they're a left-wing loony. And the same with many women and Democrat people who've spoken on it before. They actually might listen to Megyn Kelly because she's on the right wing and she's seen as one of theirs. So they might actually pay some attention to it. It's strange to think of her as a champion of feminism, but it is could actually work in our favor to actually having our story listened to.
I hope that that's the case, but I'm still doubtful because she's still a woman. And when you look at the culture of that station, of that network, and the people who are involved, I just don't know how well that's going to work out for them. I don't know that people are going to listen, because people always want to believe that the people that they trust and listen to are good people. And I think it's much easier to write her off than it is to write Bill O'Reilly off, because as much as many, many, many people disagree with him, and as much of, you know, the sexual abuse he's been accused of, people still really appreciate the work he's done in the news world. I don't, but a lot of people do. And so I think that's going to be hard, because in our society, that's more valuable than being a nonviolent person.
And if anyone wants to chip in on this or any other topic, they can phone in on 816-931-5534.
We'd love to hear what you have to say. If you want to talk about this, go ahead. If you want to talk about something else, let's chat about it and see what's going on.
So, also, people in power, the ambassador to New Zealand had previously been accused of sexist and disgusting behavior when he was at a official visit with people from Samoa. And he has admitted that when it came up. He said that it's an old story, and he has since received counseling and instruction on how to behave better, and it shouldn't interfere with him being the ambassador to New Zealand. So,
and again, I hope that that's true. I think that, you know, we're at an interesting point in both with domestic violence and sexual violence, where there's a lot of evidence that people who commit these offenses are like this for, you know, for a very extended period of time. It's very hard for these individuals to change, but there's also not a lot of research into things like batterers intervention programs that work with men and women who are abusers to kind of talk about what those behaviors are. And it's a process of admitting to what you've done and learning from those mistakes and basically rehabilitating. But there's so little research into this, and there isn't a lot of success with these programs. And I think that that's something that looking forward is important, but it's also there's so little money to help victims of these crimes. It's very hard to figure out how to prioritize that. So I'm kind of interested in seeing where that's going to go moving forward. I actually read an article recently about a batterers intervention program using mindfulness. So helping men who are abusers kind of identify their feelings, identify how they're processing things, and pause and take that moment of mindfulness to recognize their anger and then decide how they're going to channel that. And I thought that that was really great, but also something that really bothered me is that a lot of times when we have abusers who are abusive to their family, maybe to their spouse, their children, even a pet, they're not getting into fights with their boss at work. They're not fighting the cashier at Hy-Vee. You know, they're not the violence isn't necessarily leaving their home, and a lot of times they're actually very charming and very reputable in their community. They could be leaders in law enforcement and government. They could be president, even though he's not charming, and we don't buy any of that. But, you know, so I kind of wonder, I'm sure that that could work for some individuals, and I could see it being valuable for younger people who grew up in homes that were traumatic and have a lot of anger, but I don't know how that's going to work for abusers who do have a lot of control over their abuse and use it very intentionally in their homes.
It's like they save up all the anger and pain and everything from the day and then let it out at home where they know they won't get into trouble for it.
Right. And I think we all do that to an extent, not in an abusive manner, but, you know, if your boss is making you angry at work, you might go home and I won't speak for you two, but I know I come home and I'll just be in a really grumpy mood and kind of short with my partner, but, you know, not to the point of being violent, and I'm probably grumpy with everybody. I just want to keep my job also, so it helps. So, yeah, I'm kind of interested to see what we'll see in the next couple of years about these batterer intervention programs and kind of reforming sex offenders, like this was Australian diplomat?
New Zealand.
New Zealand, sorry. I'm confusing that area. I apologize to any Aussies or Kiwis listening for homogenizing.
Looking ahead, it's going to take a tremendous effort to further the cause of feminism that's going to have responsibility, buy-in, and effort from all parts of society, especially boys. Justin Trudeau, who has turned out to be an absolutely fabulous world leader, the Prime Minister of Canada, recently said in an essay that he wrote for Marie Claire magazine that boys need to be raised as feminists just as much as girls because, quote, our sons have the power and the responsibility to change our culture of sexism, unquote. He said that teaching boys to be feminists will give them a sense of empathy and help them try to escape some of the pressures that force them to act out, to act aggressively, to act violently, because they perceive that that is what it means to be masculine, that they do that in error of not really understanding that masculinity need not encompass or embrace violence and aggression.
Absolutely, and I think that helps them to understand that women are people outside of their relationship to them. It doesn't need to be their sister, their mother, their aunt, their grandmother, their wife for them to have empathy for them, that you know, we all should be treated equally. Regardless of our gender.
What I found striking was that he admitted himself that he had made a mistake on this front because he had been talking with his wife about what is the best way that he could raise his daughter or teach his daughter to become a strong feminist woman when she grew up. And his wife said, wait a minute, have you forgotten about the fact that you have two sons and these sons of ours, why aren't you thinking about teaching them to be strong advocates for women as well? And he said, gosh, yeah, that you're right. That's where it all begins. It begins not just with one side of the gender divide, but with both sides.
Yes, we have girls take self-defense classes, and we teach them things to, like, don't go out alone at night, or if you hear footsteps behind you, cross the street to see if they're following you so you know when to run. We should also be teaching guys, don't follow a woman down the street when it's late and dark. If she doesn't cross the street, you could cross the street so you won't be scaring her and be close to her and seem like you're following her. And just don't be creepy and weird in general.
I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding by generally well-intentioned people that they're not being creepy and they're not scaring people. But, you know, a large percentage of women and individuals outside the gender binary have experiences of violence by men. And it's not that, you know, again, not all men are like that. However, if that's all you have to go on, it's better to be safe than sorry. And I think that they forget that they might be making people feel unsafe by doing very normal seeming things like walking down the street behind somebody, or I walk my dog at night a lot because he hates humans and barks a lot. So I'm always walking him at night. And there will be people in my neighborhood who jog at night and jog very close and right behind. And when they whiz by, it's very startling. And I think that maybe they just don't realize that, and how we can do a little bit of education on, you know, this makes me feel unsafe. Please don't do it. Not that I'm going to stop and do it in that situation, but
I wonder if another part of the education process that I agree with completely, Ember, is sort of re-educating ourselves or helping to re-educate others on what is the true meaning of masculinity and femininity, because it seems like a large part of that meaning has been lost or diluted, that there is, you know, masculinity has become equated. Maybe that's the fault of Hollywood. Maybe that's the fault of video games. Maybe that's the fault of Trump. Who knows? Let's blame everything on Trump. Why not? But what if you ask boys, what does it mean to be masculine? They say it means to be tough. It means you don't take any gruff from anyone, that you can beat other people up. In survey after survey, young boys, when asked, what does it mean to be masculine? It means that you become violent. And if you ask young boys, what does it mean to be feminine or a feminist, they will answer, it means to be weak. It means to be submissive. It means that you let other people push you around. It means that you are basically just, I can't think of a better word for it, but you are the weakest link in society, and that the aggressive masculine people are always there to watch out for you. Yet, I think that feminism and masculinity have the same level of strength in them. It's just exhibited and manifested in different ways. It's like the yin to the yang, and it's simply that one side of it is not really being recognized truly for what it is. What do you two think maybe about that?
I think that also goes to the idea of chivalry. I've seen people complaining again and again that chivalry is dead, and saying that guys don't hold doors open. But the original idea of chivalry was built on the idea of these strong knights who could protect and who could look after this weak, fragile flower, and that women were weak and had to be taken care of. I don't think the idea of holding a door open for people is a bad idea. I think the idea of politeness taking the place of chivalry, that men should hold the door open for women, women should hold the door open for men and for each other, just being nice to people and being a civilized human being, because people just deserve respect and should be treated like people, is a much better idea than the idea of chivalry. And then men won't have to say, well, I need to be able to beat people up because I'm strong, but if I choose to, I can look after the weak. It'll take some of the pressure off them too.
I think that I agree, and I think that the gender roles are very I want to say oppressive, but I don't mean necessarily in a systemic way, although certainly there are ways, but can be very limiting to individuals, and there's a lot of insecurity surrounding that. I know I grew up as a tomboy. I was always worried about how my appearance would make people perceive my sexual identity. I was in the closet at the time, didn't realize I was bisexual, and was very insecure about that, and very insecure about how I presented, how I acted. I was always very strong and very confident. My parents raised me to be very independent, and I viewed that as anti-feminine, which is not true. I don't think it made me less of a woman or less of a girl because I was very independent. I would go out in the garage and bang nails into pieces of wood with my dad because he wanted me to know how to build things. And I think that with men, there's the same thing, that if their masculinity is challenged, that it's very threatening to their identity. I was at the store one day by myself, and I held a door open for a man behind me, because that's just what I do. I hold the door for everybody, unless they're too far away or it's awkward or I don't like them. And he got angry with me, and he approached me and said, why did you do that? I was like, I'm sorry. I'm apologizing for holding the door open for him at one point. I'm like, you know, I just held the door. He's like, that's not how I was raised. And I was like, you know, women can hold the door open for men too. He's like, no, that's not how I was raised. And he got very mad and ran away with his shopping cart very angrily. And I was just thinking, how difficult it must be for your identity and your masculinity to be threatened by, a woman. And I was wearing, sweatpants and a t-shirt at Walmart, shopping because I was stressed out. For that to be so threatening to your identity. And I think that that's kind of what these the femininity and masculinity can do to people because our society is so rigid in those ways.
Well, in his mind, you emasculated him. I mean, you basically took out the gilding knife and used it right there in front of Walmart with everyone watching. I mean,
exactly.
It's not like you ran forwards and held the door open and said, "Here you are, sir,"
right,
and waited till he'd gone in to follow him through. You just weren't rude enough to let the door slam shut in his face.
Right.
You could have added something like, you know, someone as cute as you shouldn't be opening their own doors.
You might break a nail.
Yeah, I reject the whole notion of chivalry to begin with. I mean, chivalry is a fantasy. When my brief foray as a medieval history major in college, I think I had about 50 majors, but let's just talk about this one. You read about what the knights in shining armor that Sir, you know, Thomas Malory really modeled his King Arthur, his Arthurian tales over. The real knights, they raped and pillaged and robbed and made trails of destruction across what little of civilization there was. The chivalry never really existed.
Yes, the version of the Arthurian knights in the Mabinogion is, as you say, a bunch of rapists and pillagers.
Or even the Three Musketeers. I mean, we have the Hollywood version of the Three Musketeers in Technicolor, where they're these really upright, you know, scalawags and everything. But if you read the actual book, they're horrible people. They're the sort of people you would never want to be around.
I also think the candy bar is disgusting, so link that into Halloween here for you guys.
Oh, wow, that's like a reverse plug.
Am I going to get in trouble for that?
I don't think we get into trouble for reverse plugs, but...
That is my personal opinion.
I will express my personal opinion that I like it, and we have candy wars at our house, and we usually settle it by buying two different types of candy for Halloween, because Una likes peanuts, and I don't, so we have to get a bag of each type so that we get a fair share at the leftovers after Halloween.
That's excellent.
Moving on.
Okay, what are you moving us on to?
Well, I think this idea of masculinity and femininity is really interesting to me. Maybe this is something that our listeners would like to call in and talk to us about. They can call at 816-931-5534. We are here and ready to listen to your thoughts.
Go ahead. I dare you to call in.
Yeah. We'll be nice. Yes. For the most part.
We'll double dog dare you. You have to call now.
Oh, wow. That'll light the phones up.
I saw an article this past week about how working too much is bad for your health. And they said that everyone in America tends to do this. Everyone in America tends to be working at least 45 hours a week or more. And they said that it's particularly bad for women because they have so much extra time having to deal with the emotional labor, which takes a considerable amount of energy and doesn't tend to get rewarded, and also having to deal with extra shares of the housework and doing most of the childcare and that item of that nature. So women really should only be working 35 hours a week, and it's like, wow. That is appalling. Instead of saying that people should do equal amounts of the housework and the emotional labor and looking after their kids, you're instead saying women shouldn't work as much in the workforce and therefore won't be only being doing like 3/4 of a week or something, won't get promotions, won't get decent salaries, may not even get benefits because they will not be seen as working full-time. And you're doing this for them, to help them and to protect their health. Again, it's back to that being a weak thing that needs taking care of, instead of saying, how about the men pull their fair share?
Absolutely. I work in an office that is majority women. I do research that's mostly based on early childhood, mental health. I work with a lot of social workers and sociologists, which tends to be a woman-dominated field. And there's definitely a culture of overworking where I am. People get there, you know, at 7 o'clock in the morning, stay till 7 o'clock at night. They, you know, have to pick up their kids and bring their kids to the office to work, which we totally welcome. And I love when my office mate brings her baby because he's adorable and I get to just play with the baby instead of work. But, you know, it's really burdensome. And I think a lot of it comes from the fact that a lot of us feel like we have to work a lot harder to be taken seriously. And I try to resist that because I've worked in direct service. I've worked with, survivors of domestic violence, where if you overwork, you will burn out. You will have mental health issues. So I I tried to make that line, but it also makes me look like I'm not working as hard as everyone else. So it's kind of this double-edged sword. And I've pretty much always worked in female-dominated professions and offices. So I don't know if that's been the case for you all in other offices, but that's definitely been my experience.
I know that there are various studies that actually say that you get less efficient the more work that you do. It's not just a burnout because of an emotional strain. The overexertion dulls your mental edge. And if you start going and doing 50 and 60 hours a week, you might actually, after a short while of doing that level of performance, you might actually be better off doing 39 or 35 hours a week and be more productive because you're so tired and you're just missing items.
It's almost in today's environment, though, because we're just really... Yeah, you know, they say that we are actually out of the Great Recession, but it certainly doesn't feel like that in any way, shape, or form. And if you ask most people, do they feel like the economy is generally better? They will say no, especially women who see increasing amounts of their benefits under threat or being taken away from by the current administration. It's almost as if we're in a political and work landscape of, well, to paraphrase Montgomery Burns from The Simpsons, where he said, friends, family, religion, these are the demons you must slay to become successful.
I think, you know, within the last 20 or 30 years, we've had inflation, but wages haven't caught up to that inflation. And that's hard for everybody, but it's especially hard for women, especially hard for women of color, for Hispanic and Latino women, and for transgender individuals, LGBT individuals who make less on the dollar than, you know, your generic white cisgender man. So it's hard on everybody, but as we see, you know, economic inequality grow, it gets harder and harder for those specific populations. So...
Yep. On the 10th Voice earlier today, we had a guest, Susan, who talked about how significant her economic choices were limited when she transitioned from essentially being a gay man to a transgender woman, and how where once she was able to get positions of authority, and I've seen her resume where she was a manager, assistant manager, a project manager at different companies in the area. Now she's the stock girl, she's the wait staff, and so forth. She's facing a double discrimination of not just being transgender, actually a treble discrimination. She's transgender, she's a person of color, and she's a woman. And that the reason we had her on our show was in part because she has a job and she works diligently at it, but it cannot pay the rent. And so she's had to turn to sex work to make up the balance so that she can pay her rent and buy groceries, or pay her rent and have electricity, you know.
I read an article, and I wish I could remember where it was from, but it was about how sex work has been actually very helpful for individuals with disabilities who are having trouble getting work because they can do it from their home. They can cam, they can do chat sites, they can record videos and upload them. And it's become a way for a lot of disabled women and disabled transgender women and men to get work. And so it's interesting to see how sex work and has played into this kind of economic inequality.
But they have adverts on TV for people who are getting their side hustle on, and it's always things like Uber or Lyft that they show. They're not going to put that out as a side hustle.
Oh, I hate that expression. The expression side hustle is a very polite euphemism for I'm underemployed and due to this really awful economy we're in and due to terrible policies, and so I have to work two jobs just to try to keep from starving.
Or you're fully employed, but you're so badly paid because they won't raise the minimum wage that you can't support yourself even full-time.
And I think that's why companies like Uber and Lyft and Shipt, which does like your own grocery shopping for you, people can grocery shop for you, which is a service that a lot of people need or want, but... why they're successful, because no one that I know of is able to live full-time being a dog walker or a taxi driver, you know, for Lyft or Uber. And they really thrive based on the fact that a lot of people can't get full-time work that is at a living wage that can help them support themselves and pay for insurance and children and rent and all those things that you have to have to be able to live. And so I think that's actually a sign of the economic inequality that we have.
And speaking of economic inequality, we're going to do the opposite and have a brief word for saying thank you for people that helped during the fall fund drive. So we'll be back with you to discuss things in a second.
To all of our generous donors, I'm Bridget Lynch, and I just want to pass on to all the listeners who donated in the Fall Fund Drive a heartfelt thank you from all of our champions, hosts, DJs, board and committee members, staff, and every other volunteer who put forth their time, talent, and treasure to make this pledge drive a success. We cannot do this without all of your support. KKFI truly is the voice of the community by the community. Thanks again, and remember, you are always a member of the community here at KKFI.
Johnson County Meals on Wheels is looking for some volunteers. If you are interested, please contact them at 913-715-8895. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And you're back with everyone. We're talking about issues that affect women and the men who support us. And if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 816-931-5534.
Yeah, I read an article, I think it was in the Atlantic or the New Yorker, I know, very cosmopolitan fare for Kansas City here, about how the flight and the drive of young couples to have their own independent house has actually been discriminatory against women, because in the first half of the 20th century, before World War II, it was very common, it was actually almost standard, that you would have three generations living in one house, and that the fact that you had that much of the family pulling together meant that the grandparents could help out to some extent raising the kids, and that the kids could help out raising the grandparents. So it was actually it turned into, I guess, a feminist issue, and it was the way that they were casting it, that the flight to segregation and separatism and the white flight actually had a negative feminist consequence. And it's fascinating to read and to find out that nearly everything that you think of in modern society today seems to have some impact upon the depth and the breadth of what impacts feminism.
It also actually impacted care for the elderly, because if everyone lived in the same house, the elderly actually got to feel that they had a purpose. Instead of just being discarded and on the trash heap as soon as they stopped working and no one paying any attention to them, it helped both ways. It helped both the young, who connected with their elders and got to learn more about their history and their family and have a continuous care for them. It also let the elderly actually share that knowledge and feel valued.
And I think, too, you know, there's this idea that cities are not safe for women and they're not safe for people in general. And that's kind of where white flight came in. We had white families moving out of the inner cities into the suburbs in the 50s and 60s. In Kansas City, you know, J.C. Nichols was one of the developers who's responsible for the way that Kansas City is today. And a lot of those deeds on the houses and neighborhoods that were developed by Nichols didn't allow African Americans to own property, didn't allow Jews to own property. And some of those deeds still exist because the deeds aren't challenged unless the buyer wants to challenge it. So while it's not enforced, I mean, we still see signs of that history in our city. And with the truce divide, of course, this is affecting across racial boundaries. But again, everything that affects our economy and our society negatively is going to have a greater impact the more intersections of oppression you have. So for women, for single mothers, for people who are living below the poverty line, are going to see that greater. And, you know, when we see studies of the urban environment, the more people who are out on the street, the more people using public transportation, the more people who are out walking to and from work, the safer the environment is, because there isn't going to be, you know, what we think of that like back alley crime where there's a burglar with a black and white striped shirt with a gun going to rob people. I mean, that just doesn't happen in these busy cities where there's equitable housing, there's affordable housing, there's adequate public transportation. Law enforcement is equitable and well enforced, but not over policing. I could talk about how urban planning can affect the economy and women all day, and I won't bore everybody, but I think that that does really have an impact on the lives of women, especially on families.
I think you could talk about it all day, but I think Donna Wolf would get cross if you kept going beyond four.
That is probably true.
Yeah, there was a short feature, I think I caught it on KCPT recently, where they were interviewing the head of an HOA, of a former J.C. Nichols Homes Association, where they were talking about, well, it says in your covenant for the Homes Association that you don't allow Mexicans, you don't allow Eastern Europeans, you don't allow all these other people, you don't allow African Americans, and said, why don't you vote to change that? Why is that still on the record? The HOA can remove any part of the covenant it wants to. And they said, very frankly, because I'm afraid if we put it up for a vote that to remove it, that a majority of the residents will vote against removing it. And they said, but why on earth would they do that? It hasn't been legal to discriminate like this in decades, not since the Fair Housing Act in the 1960s. And they said, because a majority of them are honestly expecting that somehow, some way, the administration of Donald Trump will swoop in and start to negate parts of the Fair Housing Act, to start to make it legal to discriminate in housing again.
I mean, we've seen with Donald Trump's real estate properties that that's been a huge problem. And it's a huge problem for properties across the country and in Kansas City of discrimination. Even though it's not legal, it still happens.
Yes, you just have to make an environment unpleasant enough that no one wants to live there.
Or, yeah, and making credit lending practices predatory to people who live in minority communities. As soon as you cross truce, you see cash checking or check cashing places and predatory loan operations all over the place, and that negatively affects credit. And even if individuals are able to move out of that, they still have these dings on their credit and aren't able to get housing in those areas. So it's like, there are lots of ways to prevent people you don't want living in your neighborhood from living there, unfortunately.
Yes. Despite the fact that there are supposed to be laws that protect people or give them preferential rates as first-time homebuyers, you still have to get enough of a credit record to perhaps be able to do that, or you end up in the catch-22 situation of you could afford the house, but you can't afford the extra payment that you have to make because you couldn't get a down payment together.
Right. Or you are getting offered bad loans by banks who know that you're going to default on those loans.
Yes.
I'm old enough to remember when my mother was trying to get a loan to buy a Toyota in the 1970s, that they would not take it just on her credit alone. They insisted that she had a man co-sign, or else they would not be inclined to make the loan for her. It hasn't been that much longer than that women weren't even allowed to have credit cards, correct?
Yes, it's about that time. It's like 40 years since women were allowed to have credit cards in the U.S.
And I think that there's this idea that women now, that we have so much more opportunity, and we do, absolutely, and we thank the women that came before us for securing that. However, that impact is not gone yet. You know, there are still ways that women are suffering because of those ideals that happened in the past. I was actually talking to my husband about policies in China where, not policies so much as the economy, where plenty of people owned homes in, you know, the early 90s, and they were able to get that housing. And then within the past 15 years, the housing market exploded. So if you owned a home in the 90s, you are now basically a millionaire. And if you didn't own a home, it's impossible for you to buy anything now.
But there's the catch-22 again. You're
right,
a millionaire,
exactly.
But you would still need to buy a house somewhere and have somewhere to live.
Right.
So you can't realize it.
Right.
And there's the catch-22 we were saying earlier about boys have to be raised to be feminists, or at least humanists, respect everyone equally.
Right.
If you don't like the feminism word, but
also
the parents, but the parents, to do that properly, the fathers have to actually demonstrate that and live that by helping
Absolutely.
Equally with the housework and speaking respectfully of women or jobs that women tend to end up in, and not picking on the boy for perhaps showing emotion or doing something that's fair and just and saying, oh, well, that's a sissy thing.
Right, absolutely.
And you've got that hangover from before, that, like you were saying now, about the echoes of the past still ride the future and limit us.
We see incremental change across generations, but it's incremental. And until, you know, it might be a few more generations till we see equality, probably a lot more, but
there's a lot of shows that we could make off of some of these topics. I mean, the financial justice and financial equality and how that impacts women's rights, discrimination in housing, discrimination in jobs. It almost overwhelms you when you really think about it, just how pervasive and systemic it is throughout all of society.
Discrimination against the disabled.
Yes.
The ADA only says you have to make a reasonable effort, and everyone has a different opinion of what's a reasonable effort. But if you follow someone around who's on crutches or in a wheelchair for a day, and you see how many places they could easily get access to, but there is just one step going into it, mm-hmm. and that just blocks them totally. It's a small step for everyone else, and it's impossible for them.
Yeah, I think we have a lot more to talk about and a lot more progress to be made.
And so that means that you can come back and listen to us talking about a lot more next week on Every Woman. And Sharon Lockhart will be back from her brief vacation with us next week. And do stay tuned, because coming up we are going to be having Urban Connections with Donna Wolfe. And after that, we will also be having Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with MC Richards. And stay tuned. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Una Nowling and Amber Urbach.